What are the key principles for psychological work? How do we know if we are doing this work properly? How do we know we're not BSing ourselves or deceiving ourselves? In the next couple of episodes, I'm going to take you through the key principles for psychological work. This will keep you out of self-deception and out of BS and into confronting the truth of why you are as you are. Remember that this psychology is the study of why you are as you are, and we can think of psychological work, therefore, as discovering why you are as you are and changing that if need be. And all that boils down to the process of changing it is self-awareness and habit change. In fact, all psychological work boils down to self-awareness and habit change. This is a Deep Psychology podcast. I'm your host, Ross Edwards. I have new long-form episodes every Wednesday and snippets on Thursday, Sunday and Tuesday, all at 9 p.m. Central European Time, 8 p.m. UK Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And a quick mention that you can stay up to date with my latest episodes and projects via my newsletter. There's a link in the description and you can find my books there too. Also want to say before we get started, I really recommend you go and listen to my first episode in this May and June series on psychology, and that is called What is Psychology? That's a really foundational episode. You don't have to go and listen to it right now, but after this, certainly go recommend you go and listen to my episode, What is Psychology, from last Wednesday. So I'm really just so excited to get talking about this, the key principles for psychological work. We're not going to cover techniques right now. Think of these as like the principles to use whenever you're applying any technique. So imagine you're going to the gym. I'm not going to be telling you how to lift weights. I'm going to be telling you the principles of exercise and of fitness. So this is like very, very high level. And I'm doing it because I see a lot of blind alleys, an American term. I see a lot of dead ends and blind alleys in psychology and in self-help and in spiritual work, and people just spending years spinning their wheels, not really getting anywhere and not really experiencing deep fundamental change, not discovering deep aspects of why they are as they are and not changing deep aspects of why they are as they are for the better. In other words, not really doing powerful psychological work. Let's get to the, well, there are four principles, but my episode next week is not fully ready yet. So it might be more, because once I get talking about these things, I can get talking all right. But for now, there's four. Four principles for doing deep psychological work. Truth, first cause, non-duality, and construction. And today we're just going to look at two. And the fact that we're just going to look at two shows you how deep and all-embracing, all-encompassing and crucial these principles are. We're going to look at truth and first cause today. Let's get right into the principle of truth. And when I say truth in this context, I mean something very, very specific. So let's really lay out what that is. In fact, the idea of truth is really the core idea behind all of Gestalt therapy. Now, I'm not a Gestalt therapist, but I think it's just really useful that Gestalt has come to this conclusion, or this is sort of the principle that underlies most of that school. And I have sort of come to that conclusion through coaching people, through meditation, through reading all kinds of different material on all kinds of different topics. And this is one of the key principles I have come to. And I haven't copied Gestalt. I've not even studied Gestalt. I just know that this principle underlies it. Now, I'm not saying that I'm going to be necessarily doing a faithful reconstruction, because that isn't my goal. My goal is to give an original contribution. But if you do find parallels between what I'm saying here about truth and what Gestalt therapy says about truth, don't be surprised, because ultimately we're talking about the importance of truth in psychological work. So remember that psychological work is about discovering why you are as you are and changing it if need be. Now, truth really speaks to the first part of that definition, discovering why you are as you are. Because when we say why you are as you are, what are we saying? We're saying we're trying to find out what is the truth of your identity, yourself, your mind, your behavior, your actions, your psychology. And truth is so important because the process of doing psychological work both requires truthfulness and it develops truthfulness as well. So one of the key goals in psychological work is to be truthful with yourself, sometimes ruthlessly truthful with yourself, and with your coach or your professional, whoever it is. And the process of doing proper psychological work develops your ability to be truthful. So it's like a positive cycle. Or if you're not being truthful, it's a negative cycle. And truthfulness just means seeing whatever is real about who you are, regardless of whether you like it or don't like it, whether it fits with your image of who you are, whether it reaffirms your identity or not. It's just, what is the actual truth of my self, my identity, my mind, my emotions, my behavior, my actions? Let's really ground this from the start with an example that some of you maybe haven't actually experienced from within, but one that is really unavoidable, and just one that we've probably all experienced to some extent in our life. If not ourselves, maybe through a family member or a friend, or, you know, just someone you know. Let's use the example of that you're an alcoholic and you're going into therapy for an addiction problem. How does the principle of truth apply here? And you might think at first, well, truth, how does the principle of truth apply to an alcoholic? They're just addicted to booze and that's the problem. They just can't stop drinking. There's nothing to do. It's nothing to do with truth. Well, no, that's not true. It's actually foundational to the entire problem of addiction is truth. In fact, the first obstacle that the addict will face and the therapist in their assisting of the addict will face, in other words, the first obstacle faced in the therapeutic process, is truth. Because if you've ever known an addict, or if you yourself have had any kind of addiction, you'll know that, for one thing, simply admitting that you have an addiction is an enormous problem and an enormous source of resistance and avoidance and denial. In fact, many addictions are concealed by denial, not just from the person who's addicted, the addict, but from the addict's family, their friends, their loved ones. Because it requires a lot of honesty to admit that you're addicted to something. It's psychologically tough to admit it, because when you say that you're addicted, you're basically admitting dependence and a certain weakness, because you're sort of admitting that you cannot help yourself and that this thing gives you something that nothing else does. So you're admitting a weakness, you're admitting a dependence, right? And that is just, depends on your psychological makeup. But for, and I have seen this in my own, in people in my own life, and to myself, when I've had bouts of not extreme addiction, but I would call it mild addiction, which often we, most people experience at some point in their life. It's just, you're not honest about it. You're really not honest about it. People can see the behavior on the outside, but you will not, you will not want to admit either to yourself or to them that there's actually a problem here, because that is just, it's just too painful. And it's painful as well because as soon as you admit it, you admit that there's actually a problem and therefore there's something that needs to be fixed. Whereas if you're an addict and you're an addict and you just deny it, well, you don't have to do anything about it. You don't need to change anything. You can just stay in your addiction. And yes, it might be ruining your health and ruining your finances, ruining your family, ruining your friendship, ruining your social life, ruining your self-esteem and all the rest of it. It's still more comfortable to stay there because it's like, well, it's a well-worn groove, it's a well-worn track that you're walking down over and over again, and it's just easier to stay on it than to make a big change. And notice that these statements I'm making, things like other people can see it but you can't see it and you do not want to see it, and these other things that I've said about addiction, really applies to all of our psychological traits that we do not like and we don't want to face about ourselves. And how many of those do we all have? And of course you're going to say, Ross, I don't have any. Well, that just shows us the importance of truthfulness and why it's so challenging, because we all, without exception, have traits that are less than optimal. And one of the main things that is blocking us from them, from even seeing them, from even discovering them, which I said is the first part of psychological work, is simply discovering. The main thing is that stopping us from even seeing them is just truth, or the lack of truth, our inability to face the truth. And then, if you get the person to actually admit that they're an addict, well, listen, if they're in therapy, they've probably already admitted it, or they're starting to like come to the conscious realization that they're an addict. But, you know, play along. Let's say they've admitted it and it's all out in the open, at least between the therapist and the client. Well, the next obstacle is identifying why are you addicted. And this is possibly even worse, because think the addiction has been built up like a sort of coping mechanism that is compensating for something, usually an emotional thing or a need that isn't being met, or misery or depression or anxiety or just a lack of meaning or joylessness. But imagine an addict admitting with full honesty why they're addicted to what they're addicted to. It's very difficult that will happen. So if you're facing the reasons behind your addiction, you're going to find all your defenses, all your justifications, all your denials, just to get to the bottom of that. You know, like if you're an alcoholic and you're trying to admit why you're actually addicted to this thing, why you're trying to, I'm not saying you know why on a conscious level, but I'm saying you're trying to get to the bottom of that. You're going to have so many justifications. You're going to have so many things that cleverly sort of justify it, explain it away, minimize it, And all of this is going to shield you from the truth that lies underneath it, which is that there's an actual reason that you're addicted to alcohol. It's not just because you like drinking, because there's other things that we like that we don't get addicted to. And there's no reason necessarily why you have to be addicted to alcohol. Many people drink it and never get addicted to it. So there's actually a reason there. And the problem is you don't want to face it. I actually want to claim that deep down, when you're addicted to something, you do know why. You do know why. Deep down, you know exactly why. And this reason is what is perpetuating the entire thing. It's like the sun, you know. The sun is always there. Sometimes behind the clouds. Sometimes it's below the horizon. Sometimes we're in the shade. Sometimes we're indoors. Sometimes we've got our glasses on. Very rarely do we look at the sun. Because to do that, you can really hurt your eyes by doing that. That's a bit how we experience the truth of ourselves. That's often what truth appears to us. Feels like this blinding sun. Now, it's actually not like that, if you're able to stomach it. I mean, listen, if you're unstable and you've got serious like emotional issues and stuff, well, yes, maybe it is really like a blinding sun that you cannot look at. Otherwise, you're going to get hurt more than just looking away. But if you have some ability to face the truth within yourself, then it's like this sun that you don't want to look at. But when you look at it, you realize that actually that was your power. And all of the pain that you were going through and all the struggle that you were experiencing and all these defenses, they were just ways of looking away from the sun. And it wasn't helping you. It was actually causing you pain long term. But the message is, however you want to describe it or try to picture it, we erect all kinds of barriers to truth. We do. It's something like, if you really take this principle of truth seriously and you join me for the ride this month in my psychology series, because we're just going to be doing this over and over again and we're going to be doing techniques for this stuff, you're going to realize how much BS is inside you. And that, I don't say that to be judgmental. I'm just saying it because it's the human condition. Look around you, look at yourself, and you'll realize that we really BS ourselves a lot, and we hide from the truth of who we are. We have all kinds of mechanisms behind avoiding truth, because it appears to be scary. But once you get a taste for it, you realize it's actually the freedom. Like, it's psychological freedom, and it's the key to psychological health. The tricky part is that many aspects of ourselves are repressed or denied, or they're socially unacceptable, or they're simply like punished, sometimes necessarily punished, or sometimes unnecessarily punished. Like, for example, if we all just expressed all of our sexual urges with zero filter whatsoever, might be very problematic. And that's why we have like a lot of taboos around sex and laws, not to forget, around sex. But sometimes it's unnecessarily punished, like within your family, certain behaviors might be looked down upon and even punished. Or at school, for example, a lot of times, you know, our behavior is controlled and sort of dumbed down for expediency and for the workings of the entire school, not for us and not for our own psychological health, you see. So what we do is we hide these parts of ourselves. We wear masks. We pretend to be someone we aren't. We have coping mechanisms, like if we're miserable and we can't face the fact we're miserable and we can't face why we're miserable, we don't feel like we have the power to do anything about it, well, we'll go to alcohol. And that's a way of both feeling better, but also hiding the misery under denial and under a sort of a distraction, essentially. Because you can drink and you can forget about it. And yet it's still there. We're basically hiding from who we are all the time. And though this denial and this avoidance works to some degree, otherwise we wouldn't do it, and 8 billion people on the planet wouldn't do it. We still know deep down inside us that we're BSing. Like, I'm very firm about that. And I think it's a good thing. I think it's kind of a scary thing, because you realize that the truth of who you are is actually in front of your eyes. It's just about waking up and being able to see it and stomach it and admit it. But knowing that we already know deep down, for example, why we have an alcohol addiction, or why we speak to people the way we do, or why we're introverted, why we're extroverted, why we get nervous, why we're confident, why we dress the way we do, and all these things, really just anything about behavior, action, emotion, speech. We know why. We fundamentally know why. And that's really powerful, because it's not this abstract thing. Someone else, I don't need to tell you why. I might know, I might be able to intuit why someone does what they do. But it's not for me, and it's not necessarily that I tell them. Even though I love psychological insight, it's not for me to tell them, because actually it's right in front of their eyes, and they know better than me. They know their life history. You know, I might be able to tell that someone is fake and they have a mask on, and they're, whatever that means, there's many ways we can wear a mask, a social mask, and I can intuit the reason behind that. But ultimately, I don't know the life history. I don't know the history behind that specific behavior pattern. I don't know what pain is underlying that, because I can't feel inside them, literally. All of these things, we know the truth of ourselves, and that's a very powerful thing. Another thing is, are we able to face it? So that's the principle of truth. Really crucial. And you're going to see as we go on this month, talking about, firstly, the in my next episode, the other principles of psychological work. And also when I start giving you techniques and talking about, you know, really unearthing this stuff, discovering these patterns, you're really going to see the power of truth. But before we move on to the next principle, what I would say is, just seek truth. Seek the truth of who you are, the truth of why you do what you do, of what motivates you, of why you speak to people the way you do, of why you behave the way you do, both for better and for worse. And this isn't just positive things or it's both. It's pleasant things, unpleasant things, constructive things, destructive things. It's not a judgmental thing. It's not like you need to come to the truth that you're an arsehole. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying there are reasons we do things. There's a reason. When we're truthful, we can discover those reasons. We can really go to the heart of it. And if we don't, if we're never truthful, we never get to the heart of it. Not really. You know, you can fix the problem. You can stop drinking alcohol. That doesn't mean you know why you started drinking in the first place. That doesn't mean that it won't happen again. That doesn't mean that if the same life trigger comes up, like if you start feeling miserable again, doesn't mean you won't start drinking again, does it? Just because you've been able to stop. If you go right to the heart of what the truth is in the situation, you're in a much better position. It's like the first domino. Let's move on to principle two, the principle of first cause. I'm just going to define what this means right up. What this means is that fundamentally, any behavior pattern or emotion or way of speaking or habit is motivated by one or two core factors, and that these factors are needs related. This isn't mystical or unusual. So I'm not, you know, people in like spiritual contexts or people who are getting into like psychological work, they're like, oh, there's a reason for this, and oh, there's something there you need to look at, or oh, you've got something going on there. And they often say it to themselves in a kind of judgmental way, and they say it to other people in a judgmental way. It's like saying it as like it should be a surprising thing, or it's like an unusual insight. No, it's not. It's just the plain fact of the situation that the things we do have a cause behind them, and usually it's one or two key things. Why are you addicted? There's a one or two critical causes behind that, right? It's that simple, isn't it? There's nothing mystical about it or unusual about it. Usually, in fact, these motivations or needs are rather simple and almost simplistic. Like, when you get to the heart of why you do something, and I'll give you a big list of things that you might ask this question about. When you get to the bottom of it, you realize it's actually something very, very simple, but it's obscured by all the sort of the coping mechanism and the hiding and the avoidance, which is why truth is important. But though they may be simplistic, though they may seem simplistic, they're actually more towards being fundamental and irreducible. It's like when you know, it's like, why are you addicted? Oh, because I like drinking. Why do I like drinking? Because it makes me feel good. Why do you need to feel good? Because this. You get to the bottom of it and maybe you realize that you're miserable, right? Being miserable is an irreducible thing. Like, well, no, I'm not saying it has to be an irreducible thing, but let's say that is the core reason that you drink, is because you're miserable. Notice that that is a final explanation. There's no further explanation behind that. You're miserable. I'm not saying that there is not a further explanation. I'm just saying, let's take that as the final cause. That is an irreducible thing. And when you discover what that is in your own specific examples, it gives you the power back. It gives you a lot of clarity as to why this whole thing is happening in your life. And you see how the whole behavior pattern is spun out of this very simple thing. And then you can actually address the simple thing rather than spinning all these complex webs of behavior and all of this, and to avoid the actual thing, which is in this case of the hypothetical alcoholic, that they're miserable, right? It's something very fundamental. And this is my claim with the principle of first cause, is that behind all behavior patterns or emotions or habits or any pattern at all, there are one or two very simple causes or factors. For example, why do you want to appear as being knowledgeable at a dinner party? It's because there's one or two reasons behind that, no more. Why do you drink alcohol? There's one or two fundamental reasons there. Why are you religious? There's one or two fundamental reasons there. Why are you polite? Perhaps overly polite. There's one or two fundamental reasons behind that. Why do you get angry? There's one or two fundamental reasons behind that. Why do you desire wealth? There's one or two fundamental reasons behind that. Why are you an atheist? There's also one or two fundamental reasons behind that. For example, right, you may ask this question. You know, I've been observing myself and I noticed that at dinner parties, I put on this persona of being knowledgeable and I start talking about all kinds of things and telling people all sorts of facts, and they might not be very interested, but I just feel this compulsion to tell them. And you ask yourself, why do I want to appear as knowledgeable? Do some inner work. And you might get to the bottom of it and you might realize, oh, I'm doing this because I actually feel worthless and I want validation. You know, I need to tell people about all this knowledge that I have so that they will tell me that I'm knowledgeable, so that I will feel their validation and I won't feel so worthless. Because right now, if I don't share this knowledge that I have, I feel worthless. Or you might discover, well, actually, I'm just completely fascinated by this topic and I have no one to share it with, so I just share it with anyone. That could genuinely be why you do it, right? So it doesn't have to be a negative motivation. It doesn't have to be like feeling worthless isn't a negative motivation as such. It's just kind of like, it's obviously going to create problems if you feel worthless and create behavior patterns around it. But the desire to share and to feel a connection with people over this topic, not necessarily, but it may cause you issues. People might think you're boring. People might think you never speak about anything else other than this topic, you see. In any case, this first cause actually has nothing to do, notice this, this first cause has nothing to do with the knowledge itself. It doesn't have anything to do with the knowledge itself. You know, the people around you might just think, wow, he seems to know a little bit of that topic and he seems to like talking about it. But no, it's actually got nothing to do with that. It's really about the fact that you either feel worthless or you want to connect with people. It has nothing to do with knowledge. The knowledge is just a proxy. It's just like a vehicle for it, you see. And again, I feel like we know what the first cause is most of the time, because we know the truth about ourselves fundamentally. But, and a professional can guide you to finding the first cause with techniques and so on, but they cannot know what the first cause is. They can check it with you, they can put it through their own filters and their own judgment, but ultimately they cannot know what it is. And when you find the first cause behind a certain pattern, it can be a shock. Because again, it's like seeing the sunlight when you've not looked at it, or you tend to not see it, or you tend to avoid it. It can be like this rush of clarity, and that can be a good thing or it can be a bad thing. It can be really empowering and like freeing, and like you've just discovered something that was hidden and obscure. But it can also be too much. Like if we're dealing with something that's quite heavy, it might be too much. So in either case, the behavior, for example, in this case, appearing knowledgeable at a dinner party, is hiding the first cause, or it's a result of the first cause. It's not really it's designed to address it. It's designed to make it manageable, but it's nothing really to do with the first cause directly. What are some consequences of this first cause principle? Because you might not realize how important this principle is at the moment. Well, for one thing, that entire behavior patterns are often held up and motivated by just one or two needs. When I say behavior patterns, I really just mean anything that you do, like as general as that. And it might be even be in areas where you might not think that there's any kind of deception going on. For example, you might have a long-term friendship with someone, or you might be in a long-term relationship with someone. And you might have all this complex web of moments and memories and interactions and emotion with these people. And you might think, oh, well, this is motivated by love. You know, I love my friend or I love my partner. But if you actually look more deeply, what I'm saying is there's one or two things that motivates the entire relationship, right? And when you look more deeply, you might realize that, it's actually not love. Or maybe there is love there, but not just love. There's something else going on. Maybe I feel needy. Maybe I feel lonely. Maybe I feel invalidated when I don't have this person in my life. And I'm not saying that that isn't valid. What I'm saying is that when we don't realize what is motivating our behavior, it distorts our behavior and it doesn't actually address the problem. And it tends to come out in sort of dysfunctional ways. And, you know, if you've ever been with like a needy partner, you'll know this because they feel empty inside and you give them a sense of validation. And so they chase after you and they cling on to you. And that has really nothing to do with you. And it's their own need that is they're not aware of, and they're trying to fix the need through you. Now, of course, without human relationships, you probably will feel lonely and needy and worthless. However, there's a limit there. And if you're like, feel extremely worthless without having a partner, it will create dysfunction. And I'm saying this because I'm using a specific example because we tend to think that in our relationships that the motivation is just like love. You know, I love the other person, or we have a special connection. It's actually not really as simple as that. And in fact, in those situations, there's often more. There's like a whole set of needs that are being addressed there. But let's move on to the next consequence of this first cause principle. Is that often these needs that we have, these key drives, these first causes that we have, contradict one another and produce contradictory or opposing results. This is why we feel like an internal tug of war a lot of the time. I mean, doesn't always have to be that way. We can feel that way because we're confused and we're avoiding ourselves and so on. But you have to realize that we do, as humans, have like fundamental set of needs that we have, right? And they compete with one another. And that when you're doing this work, you might find contradictory needs. You know, you might find in a relationship that you desire closeness and companionship, but you also want to be alone. You don't want too much of that, otherwise it gets suffocating, right? So this is where things get complicated. You know, humans are complicated because we have a lot of needs. And animals, for example, do not seem to have such complicated like need structures, shall we say. Another consequence of this is that negative or unpleasant behavior always has a genuine need behind it. I mean literally any unpleasant behavior you can think of, from anger to aggression to destruction to abuse to even things like murder. And I'm saying I'm not justifying any illegal activity or any harmful activity. I'm just saying that all human behavior has a fundamental genuine need behind it. So you might look at someone that's angry and that might get you angry, and you might start to judge the person. Like, why are you getting angry? You always get angry. Stop projecting your emotions onto me and all this, right? But what I want you to realize, well, first of all, you just got angry yourself, but that's a conversation for another day. What I want you to realize is that behind the person's anger, there's a fundamental need that is not being addressed. And it's not a personal thing against you. It is them trying to get a need met. And when they don't get the need met, they get angry. It's as simple as that, right? It's really as simple as that. It's true in all situations. Why, you know, if I'm reading a book and you put on some loud music and I get angry, why am I really getting angry? Am I getting angry because I don't like you? Am I getting angry because I'm judging you and hating you? I mean, I might be doing those things, but fundamentally, no, it's nothing to do with you. Fundamentally, it's because I want to read my book. Simple as that. Now, I'm not saying all examples have to be that simple. I'm not saying you should just take this example and, you know, apply it. What I'm just saying, with something like anger, there's always a fundamental need behind it that is not being met. And the anger is a kind of, it's a sort of mechanism for the person to get their needs met. That's really all it is. And it's the same. So I said that negative or unpleasant behavior always has a genuine need behind it. I'm going to say the same about positive or pleasant behavior too. So take the example of politeness. Why are you polite? Well, maybe you're polite because you genuinely want to be, you want to show your appreciation. Maybe you genuinely appreciate someone, you want to be polite. Maybe you respect other people and so on. Okay. However, maybe you do it because when you were younger, you got taught to say please and thank you all the time. I'm British, so I definitely did. Or maybe you're doing it as a scheme. You're doing it to manipulate other people. You're being overly polite to manipulate them and to hide from yourself. And yes, people do that. Or maybe there's some other reason that has nothing to do with the politeness itself. You see, the first cause principle applies to positive or pleasant behavior too. And so it's not just about traits that are we typically consider undesirable, like being angry. It's applicable to all behavior, right? And I want to end this episode on part one of the key principles for psychological work. I want to end with a final thought for you. That even doing something like therapy or coaching has a first cause, or one or two. In other words, the first cause principle applies to it. You might say, well, that sounds a bit weird. Of course there's a cause. I want to do therapy or coaching because I want X, Y, or Z. I want to understand myself better. I want to change my behavior and all this. You might think that you're doing therapy or coaching to find the truth of yourself. But I want you to be really honest about this. When you do therapy, when you do coaching, when you listen to my episodes, when you read my books or read my articles, are you doing it? What is your real motivation there? And there's so many different motivations. And in fact, motivations that have not very much to do with finding the truth of ourselves often underlie a person's desire to do therapy. And I'm not saying this to dismiss these needs. I'm just doing it to identify what is going on, really. Often people do therapy to be affirmed in their opinions. Often people do therapy to be listened to. They don't have anyone to speak to about their issues. Often they do it because they want validation. Often they do it as a way of divesting responsibility. Even though, of course, therapy should ultimately deliver a person more responsibility than they had before. The needs behind why a person does therapy can vary wildly. And this is, again, this is like a kicker. Because when I said that everything we do is motivated by one or two fundamental needs, I mean absolutely everything. And something like doing psychological work, we must also ask the question, why am I doing this? And of course, the real reason to do psychological work, the true fundamental reason, is for truth. That is the first principle, is truth, the truth of ourselves, right? To discover the truth of ourselves and then begin to change any aspects of ourselves we need to. If we're not willing to be truthful, if that is not one of the needs that we have, or if that is a need that we're not willing to fulfill, we're already done for. So this is a circular problem here. And so also we have to go meta. Whenever we're doing psychological work, we have to go meta, and we have to look at why we're doing the psychological work in the first place. And if we don't, we could just be setting up an even bigger set of tail chasing than we were engaged in before. Okay, everyone, that wraps up the first two principles behind psychological work. Next week, I will be back. Well, in fact, it's not next week. It will be in 3 weeks' time because I'm away on holiday. And what I'm doing instead over the next 2 weeks is I am bringing back two older episodes, two really fundamental episodes. I'm just putting them back and they will be republished so that you can listen to those. And I'll be back in 3 weeks with the next two or three key psychological principles. Until then, I really recommend, as I did at the start of the episode, that you go back and listen to last week's episode on what is psychology. You can also check out the snippets that have been published since that one and this one, if you just want a little taste. You can check out all my episodes on psychology, and you can check out my 200 show library by category. The links to both of those things are in the description. You can also find a link to my newsletter and books, so you can stay up to date and go deeper with my work. Make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And of course, thank you for listening. See you next week for the throwback episodes, and I'll see you in a few weeks for the next principles on psychological work. Take care.